Headliner Radio, the creative voice.
Today we're welcoming composer Ilan Ashkeri onto the show. Welcome. How are you today, Ilan?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, you're so, so welcome. Just before we get into the project which we're here to talk about, which is BBC's Earth's A Perfect Planet, easy for me to say, I just want to see how everything's affected you, you know, with everything that's been going on. Have you been able to work over the last year and continue as normal?
In many aspects, yes, and in some aspects, no. You know, being a composer can be, it often is a very lonely job. I just sit in my writing room like I am right now and make up tunes, and that's quite a solitary job. Mm. And so in that sense, it's exactly the same. And you know, ever since my daughter was born, I work at home a lot more than I used to anyway. And so that was very similar. I have been homeschooling her throughout, you know, last spring and again right now. So that has definitely made things more complicated. And you know, she's only five, and last spring she was four. So working out the dynamics of all right, you getting on with your drawing for your art class, and I'm writing some music, and we're not going to disturb each other. That's a funny dynamic to try and work out with a 4-year-old. You know,
yeah, I'll bet.
so that was challenging, but you know, but kind of wonderful to spend all that time with her as well. And then the other thing that was tremendously difficult is recording, because typically I'd go to a recording studio, work with an orchestra, or even work with one-on-one musicians, solo instruments. But you'd have this interaction, this one-on-one interaction, which is very important with music. You know, music works really well in describing things where words fail you. You know, it works at that other level. And so sometimes just trying to talk about music can be very difficult. And so that presented a challenge with the directors and the producer of the show, although we'd met quite a lot beforehand, so we had a good feel for each other. And then when I was recording, you know, that was an enormous challenge. How do you record an orchestra when you can't bring a group of musicians together? So what we did was, in Iceland, the pandemic hadn't hit quite so hard, and I'd recorded there before. So we were able to put a small string ensemble together. So we recorded our strings in Iceland, and then the woodwinds and the brass, we recorded them all individually. And this was extraordinary. These musicians, who are members of some of the great London orchestras, who we would typically record in Abbey Road Studios or Air Studios, we were getting them to record themselves in their living rooms, and then putting all of that back together. And that was a tremendously difficult process. You know, I have to applaud my producer and engineer, Steve McLaughlin. He had the unenviable task of getting all these many, many different recordings from, you know, places all over the world even, and putting them together, because the score had not just orchestra, but a lot of guitars. We had Tim Wheeler from the band Ash. He was recording guitars. He'd gotten stuck in Ireland and was at his mum's place, was recording guitars for me out there. So, you know, just as an example, there was many things like that. And so then we had to bring all these different recordings recorded in different places back together and make it sound like it was all a performance. And that was an incredibly difficult technical challenge, and also artistically a difficult challenge.
I'll bet. And I hate the phrase, but do you think this is the new normal for, you know, recording orchestras and for bits like that for the foreseeable?
No, I think things will go back to normal, but I think it will be a vibe. It will be a sound. You know, it makes me think of, you know, in London, there's this thing, especially in conservation areas, probably throughout the UK, but I'm only aware of it in London. I've got it in my house where you have glass in the windows that you're not allowed to change. And what's special about this glass is that it's a little bit wonky and wavy, and so it doesn't reflect light in a very it's not blinding when the sun reflects on it. It creates quite a nice effect, and you're not allowed to change that glass. It's considered to be, you know, a really good thing, and especially in a conservation area, you can't replace that glass. Now, that glass was made just after the war. And it had to be made very quickly and by people who weren't necessarily very skilled at making glass. And so they made bad, wonky glass. And it's just wartime glass. And as you can imagine, you know, all the windows have been blown out with all the bombing. So a lot of that had to be made. And now it's a thing. It's become a thing that people love, this wartime glass. So I wonder if these recordings, these exceptional recordings that we've had to make under very difficult circumstances, whether we'll listen back to them in a few years' time and be like, yeah, you know, they had a vibe. That was pandemic recording, and that was a thing, you know? Maybe. Who knows?
Almost looking fondly back on it. Almost, I say, very carefully.
I think, why not? You know, you've got to see the positive things in the challenge. And in fact, I like all my artwork, I like to think of in that way, this idea that there's always some kind of resistance. It might be that the budget isn't big enough to do what you need, or some other obligation, that some other restriction that's imposed upon the creative process. And actually pushing against those restrictions is where the greatest bits of creativity are, you know, and where you've really got to use your imagination. So sometimes that's how you make the best stuff.
Exactly. You've got to adapt to the times and see what you can come up with, I guess, like a true creative. And so just for our listeners that might want a little bit more info on your background, so I know you've worked on a wide variety of projects. So you've, you know, composed for a Burberry fashion show, you've worked with Tim Peake and the European Space Agency, you've done films like Still Alice, Stardust, Shaun of the Sheep, and music for The Sims, Ghosts of Tsushima, you know, and you've worked with Annie Lennox, Sinead O'Connor, Katie Tunstall, numerous others. So quite the CV there, and you're clearly not being pigeonholed, are you, into a you know, working into a certain genre of music or musical projects. Is that important to you?
Yes, it really is important. I've been very careful to choose projects that I really care about, that I'm very passionate about. And I guess that's because I'm trying to do something artistic and creative in every project that comes my way. There's got to be a reason. There's got to be a connection to me and to what I'm interested in artistically. And that may sound like an obvious thing to say, but I do think you could choose to do this in a different way. There is a place where the work that you do is more craft based, and you know, I could liken it to you know, building furniture. Maybe an incredibly artistic and brilliant at building furniture, but the furniture you build is functional, and that's a choice, that's a career choice, and there is a lot of music like that in film and television, but I don't really, that's not really what I like to do. If I was going to build a chest of drawers, if I was going to do something functional, I'd probably take more of a, you know, if Salvador Dali built a chest of drawers, it wouldn't be very functional. It would be completely wacky. It'd be beautiful, but it might not be very functional. And that's more the approach. I want to take a very artistic approach. So I'm always looking for those kinds of opportunities, and they could be few and far between in the world of film and television, and so I look for them in all kinds of places where I can really express what I want to express, and places where the work is genuinely a collaboration between me and the other the other creatives involved, or projects, you know, like with Tim Peake or with some of the ballets I've done that are originated from me and are just entirely my idea that I'm in control of.
Mm. And with the gaming, so obviously there was massive hype about Cyberpunk, but it seems like the real star has been Ghosts of Tsushima. Everyone loves this game. It's stunning, you know, everything about it. So tell us a bit about your work on that one.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear you say that, you know, but also, gosh, I feel terrible for Cyberpunk, because I think there's an incredible game in there somewhere, and it does also look amazing. But I think it's been really unlucky. But anyway, Ghost, I mean, you know, it's funny with Ghost. I was actually very reluctant at first to get involved with it. And they really came to me several times over and over again to discuss my involvement in the game. And I think, you know, my big reluctance was I imagined that the game was just going to be about, you know, a samurai slicing people up,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, a lot of sword fights and violence. And of course there is that, but the game is a lot more, but I didn't realize that. And I just thought, I don't know creatively, artistically, what it is that I've got to say about, you know, cutting people up and with a sword, you know, and you know, not that I've got any big moral objection to it. I grew up playing Mortal Kombat, so and many other, you know, fighting type games. So it wasn't that. It's just creatively, it didn't really connect. But they were really interested in a score that I had written for a Shakespeare film called Coriolanus that was directed by Ray Fiennes. And it's a really unusual bit of music. I'm always grateful when I get to work with Rafe. He really gives me a lot of leeway to come up with some crazy idea, and then he holds me to that idea. Holds me fast to it. So whatever we do has a very, I don't want to say extreme, but a very sort of the concept, the idea, the method of creating it is very, very intact. It's not in any way watered down. And in Coriolanus, it was very percussive. There were metallic sounds and other drum sounds, and there was no reverb on anything. It was really present, and it's an unusual listen if you listen to it on headphones in particular. And so and they were interested in this score that was for this very you know, art house film that not that many people had seen. And so that was interesting, that this AAA huge computer game was interested in this bit of art house music I'd made. And so I went and I met with them, and when I met with Sucker Punch, they talked me through the story, and I realized this game, I mean, of course there's a lot of fighting in it, but that's not the point of it. This is actually an incredible story, a story about a young man who is wrestling with the maintaining the tradition of the past, of everything he was taught to believe in, but having to break from that and do something new in order to save his home and save the people he loves, and the battle, the internal battle within him between these two places, and in that place of friction within himself, that's a very rich emotional place from which to start creating music. And it was a really wonderful opportunity. And I'm also very grateful to Sony, PlayStation and Sucker Punch for letting me do my thing. You know, they really supported whatever ideas I threw at them. And some of them were pretty pretty out there. You know, there was a real, I really tried to make sure that there was authenticity in my use of Japanese music. And so I really restricted myself to using these five-note Japanese scales, even when I was using the symphony orchestra. And I found these some very unusual Japanese instruments, the biwa, for example, which used to be played by samurai, but it's a very unknown instrument now. And I searched out this player and convinced her to come to London to record. And anyway, they were very supportive of all this exploration that I did. And as a result, I feel very proud of the score. They really gave me a lot of creative leeway. And I'm also really excited because it seems that, you know, the rest of the world is agreeing. The fans have been incredibly complimentary about the score, and also now the industry seem to be recognizing it I've had some great nominations at the DICE Awards, which I was really excited and humbled to be awarded for, and to be nominated for, sorry, and also the SCL Awards just recently. I got a nomination for that. So anyway, very, very excited about all that's happening with Ghost.
Yeah, I'll bet. And congratulations on your nominations there. We'll have to wait and see, won't we?
Yeah, thank you.
And okay, so on to BBC Earth's A Perfect Planet. For anyone listening, if you haven't seen it, you need to see it. It's absolutely phenomenal, stunning. But, you know, what would we expect from, you know, the BBC and Sir David Attenborough? We expect nothing less, do we? So this is your fourth collaboration with Sir David. And so how did you first come to work with him?
Well, I got invited to go and work on a project called Natural History Museum Alive. And you know, if you've never worked with David Attenborough or someone of that stature, you know, and you get the opportunity to do something like that, my God, you grab that as hard as you can. So I was extremely excited to be able to do a David Attenborough project, and on that project, David came to the recording studio. We were recording it at Abbey Road. And the thing that I remember most from that is he spent the morning with us, and he, you know, David's a very talented pianist, and he loves his music, and he can read music. And so we talked a lot about the music. It was great to have him there. He sat next to me the whole morning, and we talked and worked on the music together. It was a great experience. And he left, and it was just before we were going to break for lunch with the musicians. So I walked out to speak to the musicians just after David had left. And I went to stand on the conductor's podium to speak to them. And I've got to add here before I say this next bit that it was November, it was freezing outside. And as you can imagine, Studio One at Abbey Road, where, you know, they recorded Harry Potter and Star Wars and, you know, all these amazing things. But you can imagine that, as with any studio, it's not exposed to the outside world. You have to get through several really big doors to get into that room. And it's an enormous space. You know, you can fit a 100-piece orchestra in there. So I'm standing on the podium. It's November. And out of nowhere, a butterfly came and landed on the conductor's stand on the podium. And it was the most extraordinary thing. What was this? How did this butterfly get into the studio? Why was it alive and well in November? And it just sat there, and we were all just stunned into silence. And then it flew, and it landed on the floor and a bit of manuscript paper. And it was just a really magical moment. I like to think that David had released it into the studio as a sign of his appreciation of the music.
That's so David.
Magical like that. Anyway,
how incredible.
It was, yeah, very memorable.
Yeah, I'll bet. And so A Perfect Planet, and, you know, the associated programs that you've worked on with Sir David, so I'm guessing this is, you know, a dream job for a composer, right?
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, the funny thing is, and I hope this doesn't come across in the wrong way, after after having done three projects with David, I'd scratched that itch, right? I'd done the thing. I've done working with Sir David Attenborough. And so there needed to be... There needed to be an additional reason. What was it this time round? What was the new thing? What was the extra thing? And for me, it was the subject matter of A Perfect Planet. It's so important. Everything that program is saying, the first four episodes explaining how our planet works and how the forces that allow life to thrive on our planet, how they're balanced. And then the fifth episode, which shows us how as human beings, through the way that we're living our lives, how we're unbalancing these forces, mm-hmm. and how dangerous that is, and also explaining what it is that we can do to help and to change. Because, you know, there's a lot of climate gloom and doom, and you hear all this stuff about how terrible it is, and I don't think that's help. I mean, we need to understand that, and that stuff is true, but it's not entirely helpful. We also need to hear, well, but we could change it, and this is what we've got to do. There has to be hope, and there is so much reason to hope. Human beings are extraordinary creatures, in the words of Ash DeVos at the end of episode 5, she's a very inspiring and influential marine biologist. If you look at what we've done in the last year, with the pandemic, how humanity has risen to the challenge of getting a vaccine and the extraordinary things we've all been asked to do and we are doing in order to save lives, you could see how capable the species is when it needs to be. So we just need to apply the same determination to climate and sustainability.
Absolutely. I always find myself, when I'm watching any of David Attenborough's programmes, what can we do? And of course, they do say that towards the end, usually, what the human race can do to actually help. So the work is so important. So I can only imagine being involved in this. What an incredible project it is just to be a part of, to do that. I've seen the photos of you with Sir David, as you mentioned, at Abbey Road. So how much involvement does he tend to have, or did he have, for A Perfect Planet when it comes to the score? Or is he just more there as a supervisor? I mean, does he collaborate in any way? How does that work?
The thing is he's not the producer or the director. So my collaboration is with the series producer, mm-hmm. and the directors of the show in every time. That's the way it is. But, David is, of course, the figurehead of the show. The shows are all about him. And my understanding is of the process is that he does hear the music when he's doing his voiceover. And so I'm certain that if he had a problem with it, that I would hear about it. Mm-hmm. But no, I don't have a direct collaboration with him.
Okay.
On this occasion, everything was locked down. You know, they were recording his voiceovers. They're passing a cable and a microphone through his window into his living room. And they were recording him in his living room. He wasn't leaving his house. So there was no opportunity to meet him on this occasion and to engage with him.
Well, I'd love to see the behind the scenes of that, this grand voice that we all know, over these epic, tragic scenes, and he's doing it from his living room. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
So when you approached this project, was that an intimidating task? Where do you even start when it comes to something like this?
Well, we start with the idea first, and I said to, and this comes back to my thing about the artistic approach. For me, I said to Hugh, the series producer, I said, look, if I come on board and do this, I don't want to do it in the way that the programs have been done before. I've got to bring something new to it. Let's take a really contemporary approach. Let's not do what you've done before, this traditional orchestral thing. Let's let's do something contemporary. And that's also have a recurring theme, because often they just, you know, just the music continues from one section to the next. I said, I want to keep anchoring it back in this idea, this Mother Nature, Mother Earth kind of theme, which is the main theme music, the title track, Perfect Planet. And it has choir and piano and these arpeggio violins in it, often, not always. Let's keep coming back to that. And also let's just use guitars and, you know, have a band playing a lot of this music and some synths. And so Hugh was really up for that. And if he hadn't been, I'm not sure that I would have necessarily taken the project on. Really wanted to bring my approach to it. And once again, the team at Silverback and BBC, they gave me a lot of space to explore the creative possibilities with that. So I'm very grateful for them. You know, I think for the production to trust me, that's a brave choice, right? It's much easier to say, oh, we put this guide music in, please just do something like that. And I'm coming in and saying, I'm not that person. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to bring you a new idea. And so it's a leap of faith for them. And so when I find these collaborations and they take that leap of faith in me, I'm always very grateful for that.
Mm. And of course, the animals in David Attenborough documentaries are often given characters, for want of a better phrase. You know, you root for them, so you care when they're in danger, or, you know, the director or producer, they might want to convey a sense of danger or maybe humour or intrigue or something, just for instance. So is this all discussed with you so that you reinforce those storylines, as it were, with the music?
Absolutely. And, you know, I forgot to say in your last question, just very briefly, that the challenge, the terrifying bit is that you have all these animal characters. So normally when you write a film or a TV show, you've got your main characters and you write themes for them or motifs for them, and you keep reusing those. But when you do a series like this, you're writing 40, 45 short films. And each one is a different story and a different character, like you just said. And yes, you have to explore that. You know, you watch the scene, you say, well, this is a love story. This one's like a heist. This one, you know, you spoke just now about the fire ants. The fire ants is a rescue, a film daring, where your home is being destroyed. What are those? A disaster movie.
Yes.
You know, it's a disaster movie with an epic journey to safety. But you know, in the space of 5 minutes. And so, yes, you have to look at each scene in those terms and write the music accordingly.
Mm. And I saw as well, so instead of working with an artist to create maybe an original song that traditionally accompanies such documentaries, you wrote an original piece sung by children choirs, and it plays at the front and end titles as well as throughout the episode. So it's essentially the A Perfect Planet theme. How you created this piece, and what was your immediate sense of how this song should sound?
Well, we talked about the music being a celebration of the planet, and that was always at the heart of everything I wrote. You know, again, it's really easy to be doom and gloom when talking about climate and sustainability. So I really wanted something that was positive. And I wanted to write something that was a simple and very direct tune. The idea of getting children to sing on it came from when I was working with this melody. I said to you before, I was working in lockdown, and my daughter was being homeschooled, and she started singing the tune back to me. Now, that might sound not entirely surprising, but actually it was, because this, you know, even though she was four at that time, 4 years old, she is absolutely my harshest critic. I'll give you an example. Once we were on a long-haul flight on a plane, and she was watching Shaun the Sheep, the movie, which I scored, and I said, halfway through it, I said to her, hey, you know, do you know who wrote the music for this? Daddy wrote the music. I was like, all feeling really proud. And she looked at me, looked back at the screen, and changed the channel.
Ouch.
I thought hating the stuff your dad did would maybe start when she was a teenager, but no, it starts really early on.
Early start.
So the idea that she likes something that I'm doing, that's not a given, right?
Exactly.
But she liked this, and she started singing the tune, and I realized, well, if she could pick the tune up that easily, then maybe this is something children could sing. And the whole idea is that we need to save the planet, not so much for ourselves, right? We're you know, the problems that we're dealing with are going to be, you know, further into the future. We're saving the planet for the next generation. And we have to teach and inspire the next generation. We have to teach them what the problems are and also what they can do. You know, I'm teaching my daughter every day, you've got to recycle, we don't waste food. These are things that when I was born in the 70s and growing up in the 80s, these were niche ideas. We didn't learn that stuff. So that whole mindset, the next generation, the next world leaders, the next scientists, the next business leaders, their whole mindset is going to come from a different place. And so we have to remind everybody, the grown-ups, to teach the children. And we have to teach the children. And so I thought, let's get kids singing on this so that children can relate to it. And also the children who did sing on it, they, at first we couldn't tell them what they were involved in, but after they had finished recording it and the show was being released and we could tell them what they were involved with, they were really inspired. You know, I got messages from these kids, from their teachers. They were inspired and excited to be involved and excited and to watch the program. And so that this idea of inspire education and inspiring is really important.
Absolutely. And anyone watching the series will know it would be very hard to pick any key scenes or key pieces of music because there are just so many wonderful moments in it. But I think a lot of people will remember the red crab scene. So we see the journey undertaken by thousands and thousands of insane number of these Christmas Island red crabs to lay their eggs in the sea. But the plot twist is they're scared of the water, right? So then we follow the hatchling's journey all the way back. Did you go about creating this piece of music, and what was the sort of mood you were trying to convey here?
Well, this is a good example. Talk about mood first. This is a good example of trying to celebrate everything. The music is really positive. It's really up. I didn't want to dwell. You know, you could have written that scene as, oh my god, they're terrified of the water, you know, but really it seemed more funny. It seemed more comedy that they were afraid of the water. And so we did play, and I played a little trepidation there, but mostly the music is just really up. It's just joyous to see the land just become this red velvet cover. And I just wanted it to be happy and magical and energetic and positive. You know, it's a scene about, you know, overcoming something to do something really positive, to create new life. and then there's the baby crabs, and of course that's all fun and happy. The challenge with the crabs was recording it. It's a really great example of lockdown recording. And we recorded this with lots of solo instruments, and they were recorded in many, many different places, even in different countries. We had to record a lot of individual instruments, and I designed, you know, some of the tracks when I was recording. I knew that I couldn't get a symphony orchestra together, and of course I wanted to have this contemporary approach, so that helped. But I had to really bear in mind that all these instruments would need to record individually in different locations. So I wrote a lot of individual parts, and there's a solo violin, solo viola, solo cello. There's an oboe and a flute and a French horn. And they all play these individual lines. And the idea was to make it sound busy, lots of different versions of these crabs, all layering on top of each other in the music. And then at some of the bigger moments, the broader moments, I used some strings that we'd recorded in Iceland as well. But it was really quite a challenge to bring together, I don't know how many, but if you think about the percussion and the guitars, we're talking about 30 or maybe even 40, you know, there's bass and, you know, so many different instruments, probably 30 or 40 different tracks, and then the orchestra on top of that. And all of those tracks coming from different locations and being brought together. But what I really love about that is that somehow it's a reflection of what it is that we need to do on the planet. We need to, all of us in different locations, need to work together towards the same result. And so the trek, in a way, is a perfect representation of that. And I love that it has that connection to conceptually to what it is that we need to try and do.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we mentioned briefly earlier as well, but we've got a great clip from this scene. So the fire ants clip, which I'm sure anyone that's watched it will remember vividly. Even my sister told me this was her standout scene of the series, and I can completely see why. So as we mentioned earlier, the ants' nest is drowned essentially by a flood, isn't it? And then we think they're all going to die, but then they miraculously start to work together to build this epic ant raft, and they float around and fight off predators and make it to the other side. It's a whole journey, isn't it? Did you approach this one, and was it, as you said, a bit like you know, a disaster movie type of feel?
It's a disaster movie. It's a race against time. It's a leave no man behind. It has all these things. They get attacked by a giant monster. You know, there's all these extraordinary challenges that they must overcome, and then there's a happy ending. So it needed to have a ticking clock. I wanted to make this very electronic, and it has these very fast, agitated synthesizers, and that was the basis. And then it has these scratchy violins that I like to play. It's something I've been doing a lot of in my work at the moment. I'm not an excellent violinist by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm really good at making uncomfortable scratchy sounds on my violin. And And then it needed to also have something emotional that you could connect to. So there's some solo cello and also some more romantically played solo violin. And then it needed these epic moments. So we had these bits of brass that were recorded in brass players' living rooms and then put lovingly put together. But these big epic brass chords for the more challenging things that they needed to overcome. But it's an example of a very contemporary track, which I like as well. And a lot of the music, and this one as well, is created in a song-like structure. It has like a verse and a chorus, and it keeps moving between the two. And that was another contemporary approach that I took to a lot of the music.
Mm.
And then the end, I just always love the end of this track, because, and in fact, it was one of my daughter's favorite scenes as well, when the ants find lots of spoilers here, but hopefully everyone's watched it already.
Yeah.
When the ants finally find their new home on a high up leaf above the water, one of the little ants comes along and shoves a giant tarantula on its way,
yeah.
who just quietly moves on. And whenever my daughter saw that, she'd really burst out laughing. She thought that was the funniest thing.
I think those ants are braver than I am, to be honest, touching that tarantula. But did you score Dynasties with for David Attenborough?
No, that wasn't me.
Oh, okay, but sort of in the similar vein, so people know what I'm talking about with just these types of scenarios. So I still have not recovered from seeing that baby penguin die after falling down the ravine in that show. And there are so many devastating moments in these series. You know, you really get attached to these characters, don't you? So were there any scenes in particular in Perfect Planet that you found hard to score for that reason?
You know, there's the baby turtles, which is really a sort of crushing moment.
Mm.
I think for me that the fifth episode was really difficult. You know, the first time I saw that, I was really quite affected by it. I thought of myself as being quite well read and knowledgeable about climate and sustainability, but that episode was really, I learned a lot from it, and it really had an effect on me. And I think I just thought it was so important to get the message across. I really worked extremely hard. And in fact, I, you know, had quite differing opinions to Nick. It's a brilliant director. I love him, and I've worked with him, known him for many years, worked with him on a few projects. But we had quite differing opinions, and we had some quite heated conversations about what the music should be and how it should work. And so that was really challenging. And I found some of the things that they were saying very, I suppose, distressing, and it became very important to me to get that message across as clearly as possible.
Mm. And are there any scenes in this series that were tricky to score, you know, for different reasons in terms of what approach to take, because they were just downright bizarre? I mean, I'm thinking off the top of my head, the fig wasp segment, that was something.
But the thing is not really in that way, because, you know, when you talk about what is, you know, what are each of these short films, what genre do they fall into? Well, the fig wasps, that's a science fiction horror movie, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so but within the science fiction horror movie, it's like, you know, the protagonist ends up in this strange science fiction world, which is inside the fig, and then eventually they manage to escape this scenario and fly off. But, you know, everyone's died along the way, and all these kind of crazy, weird things have happened, right? So no, that's not what's difficult. What happens to me sometimes is it's creative process. Sometimes I sit down and I just I look at it and I come up with something and it's no problem. And then sometimes I just can't nail the theme or the vibe. It's not because of the subject matter. It's just something within me. For this project, I kept doing quick fire rounds. I'd watch the scene and I'd say, all right, I'll play this thing on a guitar for it, and I'll do that, and I'll do this, and then I'll come back round them and see if they were any good, and then try again. And sometimes it's just really hard to come up with a tune, and I really wanted everything, each animal character, to have a really good melody. And that's the hardest bit, because, you know, making the music fit, that's the craft bit. You can learn how to do that. But coming up with a good tune, I mean, nobody can teach you how to do that. You know, why is this group of notes random? And why does this group of notes make you feel something, you know? How does that happen? That's the magical moment, right?
Mm, yes, completely. And I love the mini movies, or however you've put it in there, because it covers so many different genres and scenario, like comedy. So there's the bit where these otters are popping up like Muppets hiding from Arctic wolves, and music that's a bit like horror films.
I love that you said that, because yeah. I love that scene as well. Because what's that game that you used to be in?
Oh, whack-a-mole.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you have to whack them when they pop their heads up. That's what that's like. And then you end up feeling, at first you're like, oh dear, that Arctic fox is a bit threatening, isn't he? And then you end up just feeling sorry for him, because it's like they're just mocking him.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And there's the bit with this lizard's ascending down into this, you know, volcano, and there's this absolutely terrifying sheer drop, and it's the music's like something from a horror film, you know, when the protagonist would look all the way down at the top of a skyscraper or something. I was thinking,
yeah, I mean, exactly, you know, overcoming great adversity, you know. And then also when she finally gets down there, she's an iguana, actually. When she finally gets down there, and actually she's late and she can't, and then she has to have like a big fight, you know, it's like with another,
give her a break, yeah.
There's so many challenges, but what an extraordinary thing.
I know, 8-hour climb down, and you've got a fight with other pregnant lizards when you're pregnant. It's a lot to take on for her, to be honest.
Yeah.
The final episode in the series, so this looks at the dramatic impact of the world's newest force of nature, humans, and, you know, what can we do to restore our planet's perfect balance. So how did you try to strike that somber but yet hopeful tone with the music for this final episode, or this kind of theme?
I thought, for me, what's really important was to stay out the way of the experts as much as possible. If you dramatize an expert giving you information that is negative, then if you dramatize that, it starts to become unbelievable. You know, it needs to be presented in a very factual way, but it's tricky because having no music is very, very dry. So I tried to do the absolute most minimal thing that I could possibly do, and just to let the weight of what these three experts have to say, just let that carry it. Mm-hmm. And then where there was hope, I wanted to just give that a little bit of brightness. But the music in the fifth episode it's a lot more held back than in the other episodes, because we're trying to impart fact. And when you're trying to impart fact, if you push the emotions too hard in different directions, then I feel like you're undermining the authority of the people who are giving those facts to you.
Yeah, and the message, you don't want to detract from that. Yeah, I totally get that. Okay, excellent. So I guess one final thing on this programme, do you have a particular favourite scene when you watched it, when it had all come together and the programme was out, that you were particularly proud of when it came to how well the music worked for it?
There's so many. I was really, yeah. I really loved this programme, and I really loved working with everyone on it, and all the scenes have their own inspiring moments. We talked about a few of them, One thing that springs to mind is the Sooty Shearwaters in the Sunlight episode. Mm-hmm. The director, in the very last minute, didn't like the piece of music I'd written there. And 2 days before we were recording, I had to rewrite entirely from scratch this huge 7-minute grand finale to the episode. And that was really very stressful.
Yes.
But, you know, it came out great and it ended up being one of my favourite tracks. So, you know, all worth it in the end.
Yeah, well, there you go. And so what's next for you, Lan? What are you working on now, or what do you got coming up that you're allowed to talk about?
Well, I am putting back together my show, Space Station Earth. It's a show that I created inspired by a friendship that I developed with astronaut Tim Peake and the European Space Agency. Tim contacted me before he went into space to the space station because he was a fan of my music and he wanted to use some of it. And, you know, I said to him, great, no problem, I can make that happen, but can you invite me to the rocket launch? And he said, well, no, that's a bit tricky, you know, because we are... That's, you know, in Russia and, you know, but why don't you come visit me? I'm just training at the moment at Johnson Space Center in Houston. Why don't you come visit me there? And so I wasn't going to turn down that opportunity. So off I went to Houston and went to NASA, and I got the tour that, you know, you can't get unless you know an astronaut.
Amazing.
And I got to go on the replica space station and, you know, all sorts of incredible things. It was really an extraordinary couple of days. And at the end of it, I thought, why are we just trying to, you know, help you make your short film about your trip to the space station? But I'd like to make a show. And so I did. I made this show that's on 3 giant screens with an orchestra and a choir and a synth band at the front. And I play synths and a bit of guitar on it. And we did this show at summer of 2019 in Stockholm. It was the first show. We had a link up to the International Station. And you know, and the show is just only music and image. And it felt quite risky. I was quite nervous about it. So we had the satellite link up, and there was a chap, Tim Peake, and at that point, Luca Parmitano, who was the commander of the International Space Station. So they chatted to him live in space. And then we did the show, and 10,000 people turned up to see this. Live chat to the space station in a square in Stockholm. And then I started my show, and I got to say a bit nervous, because I thought, all right, there's 10,000 people here. Are they going to stay, or am I just going to be performing to 10 people by the end of the hour? And but no, you know, all 10,000 people stayed, and you know, they laughed and they had tears in their eyes and they applauded, and it went better than I could have ever imagined. And then we planned to roll out the show across Europe, and then the pandemic happened, and so that all got cancelled. And we're just rebooking all those shows right now, and the tickets will go on sale in the not too distant future. So I'm really, really excited about that. Really looking forward to that. It's plenty of work to get the details of it all finished, but the show's called Space Station Earth, and it has its own social media on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. And so if you're interested in space, please follow it there, or just, you know, follow me on, and I'll be posting about that soon.
Amazing. What a great thing to look forward to as well, especially the last year, everything that's been going on. So a fantastic thing to look forward to. All right, and then thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your amazing work on Perfect Planet and all the other projects that you've been working on. Just incredible to hear about your side of it and how you approach these. So thank you.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
You're absolutely welcome. You can come back anytime.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you very much and have a great day.
All right. Thanks, Alice. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Headliner Radio, supporting the creative community.